This is The Conversation, Hawaii Talks on Hawaii Public Radio. Today in our studios, Lieutenant Governor Josh Green, who this summer went across the islands to see firsthand what our communities are dealing with when it comes to the chronically homeless. Mark Alexander is the Executive Director of the city's Office of Housing, which has been working to coordinate efforts to deal with our homeless crisis across Oahu. And Connie Mitchell, who will join us in progress, is with the Executive Director. She's the Executive Director of the Institute for Human Services and Chair of Partners in Care, the Oahu Continuum of Homeless Providers. IHS has long been linked with the Peanut Butter Ministry when a cup of coffee and a peanut butter sandwich, a simple act of kindness, was extended to someone in need. Welcome. Welcome to you this morning.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Also, thank you.
You know, Josh, you just sat down. You raced over here. You were in another very important meeting this morning.
Yes, we're focused on homelessness here in Hawaii and the healthcare aspects, but we were lucky today to have a new voice to the table. The Surgeon General, Dr. Adams, great human being, came and wanted to hear from my team and our health leaders from across the state. What's on our mind? What are we concerned about? And we were able to bend Dr. Adams' ear very vigorously about our desire to see healthcare basically added into across the nation the homeless question, just like we've been working very closely with Mark and Connie. We all know that housing first and housing successes and housing, straight housing, is a huge part of the solution. Dr. Adams was talking to us about, you know, what we see nationally, which is a lot of mental illness, a lot of drug addiction, and how that blends. And so it wasn't lost on him that that's the case here in Hawaii. Tomorrow we're going to take him on a tour, Dr. Adams, his first name is Jerome, to see H4, to see the Joint Outreach Center, to go by IHS, to go and see for himself what our streets look like when people may have addiction or mental illness and they're struggling with their chronic homelessness. So he was really supportive. He's a anesthesiologist, so he works in the hospital when he still does clinical work, which is great. But he's witnessed this and has talked a lot with his other fellow physician, Dr. Carson, Ben Carson, who happens to be the head of HUD. And I took that message over to Dr. Carson, too, which is help us find inventory for people, help us support housing first, and help us get people treatment and wraparound services when they're homeless so that it can be sustained and they can get better.
And Mark, you've been working with Housing First. What are you seeing out there as far as getting shelter over people's heads?
Sure. I think the connection between housing and healthcare is critical. Even healthcare now, one of their bylines is housing is healthcare. Without a stable place to call home, a stable place to put one's head down, you can't get better. You won't deal well with mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment. It doesn't mean that you don't have to have special dedicated treatment along the way, but it means that ultimately you've got to be in that stable setting. And we know it works. The City Housing First program, which we've had out for 3 years, studied by the University of Hawaii, after 3 years, 86% of the people are still in housing because they get support services, mental health, addiction services, all of those kinds of services that are tailored to them. 60% came right off the street. 90% were chronically homeless. So we know it works. We just have to scale it. We have to get it up there. And once we do that, we can help not only the people that are vulnerable, suffering from mental illness and substance abuse issues, but also the larger community. And quite frankly, it's also a lot cheaper for the community.
And our concern has been, I think, with families, because we've seen lots of young children, lots of teenagers living out on the street, and we're making headway there.
Absolutely. This is one of the things that we track very carefully, working with, you know, our state colleagues, you know, Scott's office, Morshige, LG, whoever that we need to work with. We all work together on this, Partners in Care, you know, Connie's shop and all the other different shops. And what do we see with a public-private partnership like Kaiwiki Village, Dwayne Carisu, with our own housing that's targeting homeless families and homeless singles and children? 42% reduction in family homelessness from 2015 to 2019. That's over 900 fewer people and families, over 500 fewer homeless children from 2015 to 2019. What tracks it? It's the homeless being given housing with support services that are appropriate. We know what works.
You know, we've got two storms in our backyard right now, and I recall being at McKinley when I was doing a story there for television. Happened to see a homeless man there, and he told me his story. and that was a while ago. But just recently, I ran into him at the grocery store, and he came up to me because, you remember me? He said, I have a place now. I have a job. And it was just so nice that he came up at the checkout stand just to say hi and said, hey, I'm doing okay. Wow. You know, and Connie, you just slipped in here, but you have the Navigation Center out there at Sand Island. How's that going?
So the Sand Island Navigation Center is a city funded project, and we have really encountered a different kind of homelessness over there sometimes, but it was really meant to accommodate a lot of the folks that were not wanting to go to the other shelters. They had pets. They were couples that didn't want to be separated. You know, they're, but at the same time, there are really a wide diversity of people there also. So that's also been a very successful project. You know, we've been able to really rehouse a lot of people from there as well. But we also realize that there's a twofold purpose, because we do accommodate a lot of people, like I said, who don't want to go anywhere else. So when there are enforcements, you know, we are, you know, getting a lot of people who come in. And we really have to just, you know, start from, you know, where people are at and help people understand, okay, when you come in, this is a place, Hale Maliola means a place of healing. And so we really want you to choose, you know, those decisions that would lead to a healthier life. And some people are quite, they're not quite ready to give that up. And, you know, they find that they might need to come back another time. And we have had people come back and be successful when they, you know, exited earlier.
And then do you deal with a lot of folks with mental illness?
We do, although I don't think that we have a fair measure of that over at the Sand Island shelter, but I think it's more in our outreach. You know, we've really been doing a lot of work, and the city, you know, recently, in fact, just as recently as last week, funded us to do more in the area of of outreach navigation, which really is about working with those people who are some of the most challenging people to work with, because they're refusing treatment, they're chronically homeless, chronically mentally ill in some cases, or chronic substance users, a lot of times co-occurring, you know. So for those people, we have different algorithms for helping people get off the street. Sometimes, you know, we can develop a relationship with them, and they're willing to actually, you know, start taking medication, you know, without any kind of court order. But in some cases, their conditions just deteriorate to a point where, you know, they're really a danger to themselves in that sense. You know, there's so much neglect that they have conditions that are life-threatening in some cases, or very threatening in other ways, like losing a limb or something. So in those cases, we would have to try to go for a court order.
And we were hearing that on our last show, lots of calls, lots of concern about the homeless with severe mental illness. And Josh, you went out to the neighbor islands. What was the take back for you?
It's absolutely the case. We think that there are no less than 50 people in the urban core here, and there's probably another 150 statewide individuals that are suffering with severe mental illness. They're homeless, and they need intervention. They need assisted community treatment, which we've talked about at great length, and it's going to be done gently. And when people are decompensating, that's how we changed the law this year, and we put some money in, $100,000 for outreach. And our H4 team, I do believe, is going to hire an attorney to help advocate for people to get into assisted community treatment. All those things are necessary, because some of these individuals are the highest utilizers of the healthcare system while they're also suffering the worst. If they end up in a cycle where they're very sick, in and out of the hospital constantly, these are the individuals that cost $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 per person per year. And their lifespan is 53. These are also the individuals that we do find deceased on or under a banyan tree on a park bench. And so it's twofold. We want to decrease suffering and help those who are the most seriously mentally ill. They're also often people who are very serious disruptors in the business community, because they don't know any better. They're hurting. And then finally, to get them well, it requires some kind of facility. So you're going to hear a lot about us getting some step down in medical respite facilities, whether it's at the H4 or Eddie Mercero is doing a terrific job working through the process of finding extra beds. We need these services, because Connie has staff, I've got some staff. The combination of all the work we do is meant to house hundreds and thousands of people, but there are subsets. And those with severe mental illness and maybe the addiction are, they're like the very visible homeless that you worry about day to day. So that's where we are. I think to get those 200 people off of the street it's a huge lift. We need a few more psychiatrists, which we're bringing on board, and psychologists, and we need the medication. Again, it's in partnership even with the pharmaceutical companies. We've worked with ACLU. We're working with everybody because that component, if we can save those resources and save those dollars and save those hospital beds, keep them available for other needs, then we have a lot of other resources to do the many great programs that Mark continues to promote, that Connie is constantly ready for three more programs to get help for people.
Right. And I think, you know, we heard that from the neighbor islands, is that, you know, we need the beds to deal with these folks. Yeah. We really do.
Yeah, Maui, I'll tell you real briefly, Maui, they needed a lot more outreach workers because they have a great program once they get people in, but they needed to reach out. I saw a woman, 42-year-old nurse, living in a tent. Her significant other had just gotten into housing first on some level, I believe. She was methamphetamine addicted. She came out and grabbed my arm and said, could you get me into treatment? And we got her into treatment. She needed to get into treatment before so she could be clean because she wasn't, in her personal case, just her individual case, wasn't ready to go into housing. Others do and succeed, like Mark pointed out. But in her case, she needed it. We saw on Molokai, there's only a couple homeless individuals. They don't want new programs. They want a church to be slightly repurposed so that people can get a day or two rest before they can go get very, you know, comprehensive services on Maui or Oahu. Big Island, whole nother game. East and West Big Island are also kind of different. We need, again, a lot of affordable housing, huge issue. We need a lot of housing first, huge issue. But we need the medical respite beds in both those places and probably even some low-impact housing communities like they're talking about, and I'm sure we'll mention today. We use the word Kauhale, but something to also buffer the problem.
We have a call in from the Big Island. Jim, are you there?
Yes.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
I used to be a paraprofessional mental health worker in California. I worked at a program that was a drop-in day facility for adults with a mental health diagnosis, and we got a lot of homeless in that crowd as well. Not necessarily starting out homeless, some people would start out having housing, but somewhere along the line would lose it. I see one of the biggest problems we have is with getting people into treatment. We're not meeting them at the level that they're at, and I've already heard one of your guests talk about that today, so I'm glad to see you going in the right direction. But I think we really need to just meet people where they're at, realize that a lot of the substance abuse problems is self-medication. They're just doing the best they can to make themselves feel better. And they just need some alternatives. You need to meet them where they're at. What kind of things are happening along those lines out here now?
So we're doing doing Hawaii Cares program, which the Department of Health is launching, to be a much more integrated healthcare system because we want people to get same-day treatment if they have addiction. That involves a lot of different things. The caller was absolutely right. We have far too little treatment available, whether people are homeless or not homeless, for addiction and mental illness. We also are hoping to get a lot more Suboxone into the community when it's needed. Yesterday or the day before, I was with a harm reduction folks. Heather Luska is one of our superstars. They are reaching out and, like the caller said, going directly to where people are to get them, you know, stabilized with their addiction so that when they then meet our housing experts, our outreach workers, they can get into the good programs that the city's produced, the state's produced. There are a lot of people out there that are addicted. Sometimes they're still functioning in society, but addiction rates are quite high. As many as 10% of our individuals at any time could have addiction issues. And nowadays with methamphetamine, you can slide real fast into a disaster and then, of course, be homeless like that woman I mentioned. So we get people into the few beds that we have for inpatient. We like to expand those beds. That's some of the work that we're doing. And at the same time, that's meant to supplement all of the other work that's really focused on literally putting a roof over somebody's head so that they're a little more stable and maybe even have a higher rate of success with their treatment.
So also to... to streamline access to treatment, the state also established a coordinated entry system for substance abuse treatment. So if somebody wants to get off the street, there's a number that we call, and we get told where there's an open bed. We're able to get them into treatment faster. We really want to get to the point where we can have what we call treatment on demand, so that if people are ready, we're ready. IHS actually started a Kerr House, which actually did some ambulatory detox and housed people who are ready for treatment, but they need a time, or they're waiting for their bed to open up. We actually house them and, you know, get them detoxed, you know, with medication assistance, and then also get them ready to go right in. So they might have 7 days of detox, and then after that, go right into treatment at Queens, or, you know, if they have a bed at Hinamauka or Poilani, one of the substance abuse treatment facilities, you know, we're just waiting for the bed to open up.
Yeah, I just want to add to our new outreach navigation program, which Connie was talking about, and IHS was just awarded. It really focuses on outreach. That's why it's named that. And specifically those who are severely mentally ill, substance use disorder clients, people that are really in need of help. It's a $500,000 program. And, you know, as many people don't realize, the city doesn't do health care. That's up to the state. And so we are trying to support those efforts and work with providers that can provide that kind of lift. So it's funding psychiatric support, and it's also funding legal support. So we've got that funded for at least a couple of years because of the commitment, you know, the leadership of both the mayor and the city council. We also are really trying to support the state as they try to get more stabilization beds online, because again, healthcare is the state's purview. And so, you know, when Eddie Mercero, the deputy for Department of Health, was looking at some of the sites, our Department of Planning and Permitting was in there trying to help facilitate that. But again, healthcare is the state's role. So we're really glad that the state is starting to focus on trying to get more substance abuse beds, more stabilization beds, address mental health, because, again, we can support them. Our focus has to be on our lane, where we're good, and that's infrastructure and housing. And we know how important and critical those things are.
Well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Our guests in our studio are Lieutenant Governor Josh Green, Mark Alexander, the Executive Director of the Office of Housing of the City, and Connie Mitchell, Executive Director of the Institute for Human Services. If you're just joining The Conversation, we're talking about solutions to deal with the homeless population that suffers from severe mental illness. You can join the discussion by calling us at 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. And, you know, I just saw the news the other night. There was, a volunteer that was out doing a beach cleanup, and she was assaulted by a homeless person on the beach. And you know, you just want to get help for people, because if they are a threat to themselves or to others, it's not a good situation.
Right. We're running a statewide group right now with all of the players from every hospital in the state. We had 65 people in my office the other day discussing this broad task force with Eddie Mercero, Director of Health, and so on, the hospitals, because, for one, we need to be able to admit to the hospital people who are going to hurt someone. Because they're mentally ill and they're out there, and a lot of them, of course, are homeless. We also have to decrease the impact on law enforcement. They spend so many hours day after day after day doing some of the just nuts and bolts work of moving homeless from one community to another, dealing with when there's conflicts. The average police officer spends 4.5 hours when there's a conflict with an individual who's mentally ill and homeless, and then they go to the hospital by ambulance, cost $1,200, and the hospital a couple thousand, and before you know it, we could have had 3 months of wraparound housing and social services for an individual rather than that one encounter where they were sick. Or even, imagine this, an individual who has mental illness and we admit, get them on medications, if they have a 10-day hospitalization, that bill's probably going to be $75,000 to $100,000 on Medicaid. That could be years of housing for individuals and the wraparound services. So the goal is primary prevention, to get people well, to get that mental health care into their system. And we're talking about multiple layers, the severely mentally ill that probably accosted that poor person, then the next tier of people that are on the edge. Remember, if you're on the street for 6 months or more, you're probably going to be suffering PTSD. You probably will have been sexually assaulted if you're a woman. There's just so many catastrophic outcomes that occur if you're on the street for too long, all of which result in very, very impactful health conditions and high costs.
We have another call on the line. Kathy from Kahalu, you have a question?
Good morning. Yes, I would just like to know what the speakers are doing to provide or involve families or local families who are trying to support their especially newly diagnosed mentally ill / substance abusers who really are on the edge. I have had a horrible experience trying to get help, and I think the windows of opportunity are at that door with families. And is there anything involving them? Because I know the privacy laws are pretty strong around this and keep us, our hands and mouths bound.
I think one of the organizations that has been very powerful in supporting families is NAMI. And, you know, that's the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And their local chapter here has been so helpful. I just attended a meeting yesterday where we were debriefing our crisis intervention training for Honolulu Police Department. And they've been a major player in really helping our officers who go through the training understand mental illness better and really giving them some tools, you know, to really better help. And along the lines of what the caller was asking about, one of the things that we learned from the officers was that one thing that they get called about a lot are family members who are dealing with someone who is either mentally ill or substance abusing and not knowing how to deal with that. So I think the NAMI group really has a lot of good family support. I also think that there's room for people connecting with the Mental Health Association of America or Mental Health America Hawaii, and they also have some support groups as well. But I think we really do need to come together as a community to really help those families understand what they're dealing with and understand where they got to stop and just let professionals get involved sometimes, because they just wear out the families a lot of the time. And it really is something that I struggle to really deal with, because I'm a psychiatric nurse myself, and I really want for those families to know there's other things that they can do.
We did have a couple of representatives from both those groups in here recently, mm-hmm. and I know one of them mentioned that they had a situation where I think it was their child was able to get treatment in Japan. You know, their circumstance was different in that I think the child spoke Japanese, mm-hmm. but that was also a resource which I wasn't aware that was available.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there may be people out there in the community who might not know that and might have a certain circumstance where that would work too.
Yeah, that's why I think those groups like NAMI and Mental Health America are absolutely critical. They're part of the solution. It's not just government. It's not just professional health care. It's these agencies that can really kind of connect, and we see their importance. I think Connie mentioned something that's really important, the crisis intervention training, the intervention teams that HPD has. They trained and certified over, I think it was 47 officers already. They have a new training class that's starting next week, and it's really to give our police force the skills to deal with anyone experiencing some kind of mental illness, not just homeless persons, but ordinary citizens. So many of us are impacted by mental illness. And I think that's part of the challenge here, too, is to make sure we get the stigma out of mental illness so that we can help everyone who might be suffering from that.
And I think also helping members in our community, you know, whether it's the librarians at our public libraries, you know, which opens its doors and deals with folks that maybe have some great difficulty in kind of just navigating social situations. And I think they're doing their part to train their staff.
I think one of the things is that, you know, our local culture is very tolerant. And so we really, you know, have a lot of aloha, and we really wrap ourselves around a lot of people to support them. But at some point, sometimes, you know, people have to realize when people are stepping over boundaries, and they really, the best and most loving thing to do is to set those boundaries and actually get a professional involved. For instance, you know, if someone is using drugs, is addicted to ice, you know, and they're taking advantage of their family, a lot of times they're stealing from their family to support their drug habit. That has to be something that the family is willing to put a stop to by sometimes even having to call the police. And they're very reluctant to do that a lot of the time. You know, both as what Mark was talking about, the stigma attached to, you know, someone getting arrested or something like that. But really, it's, you know, being willing to do that, which is sometimes the most difficult to do.
And that's to break the cycle, too, because no family can sustain treatment of someone who's got schizophrenia or drug-induced psychosis and then has all those downstream catastrophic issues, which are just so hard and exhausting to deal with. You need to get a health professional engaged. I think I heard in that woman's voice, God bless you out there, that it's hard to find a doctor or a nurse right away, but you do need to get hooked in as soon as possible, because the earlier treatment begins so that there's not sustained, untreated mental illness, the better the chance that you're going to break the cycle and get into a nice, stable, regular space, again, with your loved child. Don't do it alone at all, and sometimes it's straight up unsafe. Better to start right away, call the hotlines that we've got, or go to the hospital and get started.
That hotline is 832-3100, so if you need help, please call.
Okay, well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. You can join the discussion today. We're talking about homelessness and severe mental illness. Call 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
Coming Saturday, August 10th to HPR's Atherton Studio, guitar slinging, storytelling, singer-songwriter Gordon Freitas brings an evening of folk rock, classic songs, and Hawaii-inspired originals. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
Business is slow and the folks are coming down with the holly of a bypass blue.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, why did crime suddenly begin to fall in the early 1990s?
Well, I think maybe legalized abortion might have reduced crime.
The research behind this controversial theory and the results of a new follow-up analysis.
A sensible thing to do would be to look and see how the predictions had turned out.
How did they turn out? What's this mean for abortion policy, for crime policy? It's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7, following Counterspin.
You are back with The Conversation, and we have a couple of calls on the line. We go to Hilo. Paul, you have a question for Lieutenant Governor?
Oh, yes. Hi, Lieutenant Governor. I just wanted to see if there's been any discussion on using Kalapapa as a possible resource for the severely challenged homeless, since the Department of Health is still the managing agent. And I'll get off the line to hear your response.
That's an extraordinary comment, Paul, and thank you for that. We did talk, interestingly, about Kalaupapa today because our Surgeon General went down there with the Director of Health yesterday. There are very few patients there. It has not been discussed presently. I do think Kalaupapa is probably going to become a national monument. What has been discussed is making sure that 50 beds become available through the Ohana Zone program that the state funded over in Hilo at the old facility, where we'll be able to have step-down beds, mental health care access 24/7, and getting people medical respite so that the chronic homeless situation, which I went and saw in person, of course I'm from Big Island with you, have been wrestling with. So those beds, to get the more unstable, mentally ill individuals into a place where they can get stabilized and then on to permanent housing, is the goal currently. There is no question that we have to have some areas of care for people where they can get a ton of mental health care services around the clock. That's usually reserved for the state hospital. State hospital has about 200 patients at any given time. Its capacity is a little less than that. It's always overflowing because people are sent there by the court system for addiction-related violence. We are building out a new wing of the Hawaii State Hospital to provide a lot more service. Hopefully many extra beds for those just have mental illness, not violent addiction. So these are the pieces. I'm open to any solution. Kalaupapa is an interesting one, and that's why these shows are great, because as really interesting ideas emerge, you never know what's going to catch on. The circumstance is obvious. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of people that any given year are going to need pretty advanced behavioral health care. So that they don't fall into homelessness or are out there on the street suffering. So the world's changing a bit. I would say this, that the drugs out there are much tougher on the body and the brain than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And those drugs cause severe traumatic brain injury, and that's a lot of the individuals that you see suffering. So they'll need homes and places to be.
And on the point of Kalaupapa, I know I think you're down to less than a dozen residents there, and that it's probably going to be the focus of another show, I think.
Yes, it's an amazing place. And there are, I think, going to be regional centers of excellence that occur and exist. From the health perspective, Eddie and I are working on a lot of different kind of seamless systems of care. Some of them do start right on the street, where we provide community paramedicine and outreach mental health care. We were talking in the break with Mark about mental health triage, or care that can be provided like first aid. It's a new era, because so many of our American citizens, over 500,000 any given day, who are homeless, many of whom have mental illness and addiction, need that triage and outreach, and maybe not a hospital bed, but they need a little help so that we can engage them into the housing system.
And let's talk about that, because, you know, with IHS, you know, it was the peanut butter ministry, and it was, you know, a peanut butter sandwich. You know, it's food and shelter. It's just that compassion. You see somebody and you want to help them if they're hungry. You see them on the street, they need medical care. You know, talk about that more.
Well, I think part of what we're dealing with is a shift in culture. We've learned a lot from research, and, you know, both city and state, we focus on evidence-based best practices. That's where we should put our focus. IHS has evolved to meet the growing understanding of homelessness and how it's evolved on the streets, and the kind of services that are actually helpful, which is why, for example, now we focus on housing first. We have psychiatric and legal supports for people. We do sophisticated outreach. It's becoming more strategic rather than complaint-driven. We have to change as we understand our homeless population better. It's also where we need the community more involved. I think one of the things we're learning is the importance of real community for those experiencing homelessness. Not the shallow kind of sense of community, because sometimes they just support each other in their addictions, but a sense that the whole community cares for those experiencing homelessness. Again, Kaiowiki Village, Dwayne Carisu, he puts community at the very center of what they're doing over there, not housing. It's community first. So having care. Care means providing people the proper medical supports that they need. You know, our medical examiner did an analysis of people dying on the streets. You know, as LG mentioned, the average age under 53. 90 last year died on the streets, the highest ever in any year for the past 5 years. So we are adjusting how we are approaching this issue because of the population.
What I love is that you came in here with cards and that you can pass out to the homeless if they need housing. You know, there are a number of numbers and organizations that you can just hand this over and you can get them help.
Yeah,
talk about what you're doing.
Sure. So we have these resources. People sometimes say, hey, these resources are kind of silly because people who are severely mentally ill aren't going to be able to use them. I go, of course, they're not designed for those persons, you know, but they're designed to educate the public about, hey, there are ways everyone can help. So we have these resources available. We've printed, you know, 35,000 of those cards alone. Our new homeless help card, over 20,000. We have a resource. All these things are available on our housing website. 10 ways for the community to help those experiencing homelessness. One of them is being an advocate. We know we need more housing first. We need more support for the Rental Housing Revolving Fund. We have hard numbers. This stuff isn't anecdotal. It's very substantiated by data. We need to encourage the state legislature to fund more mental health and substance abuse beds. You know, the state hospital expansion will not meet the needs of our community. We all know that. So we need more of those kinds of services. Have the public advocate for that.
Okay, so you have these handouts for people. So if people want to get these to be able to either hand them out to folks in the neighborhood or help call and connect them with these services. I mean, it's something they can do. It's,
yes,
it's tangible.
Right. In fact, we encourage people to do this instead of giving money to panhandlers, is give them a help card. And they're available from our office at Honolulu Holly. All of our providers have these resources. The idea came from our director of emergency medical services, Jim Howe. So we listen to ideas that come from wherever, and then we try to implement them.
Catherine, I wanted to add to Mark's comment about the need for community. You know, we found that in our Housing First program, after people get housed, one of the most troublesome things that happens is that people get really lonely. Mm-hmm. You know, if they've been isolated, you know, it's really our job to really get them integrated more into the community. It's really connecting them with supportive networks like faith communities, different churches, you know, really encouraging them to get engaged, you know, with other activities in the community. Because really, that isolation is not good for people who have mental illness.
I think that's absolutely right. A couple observations and a proposal. When we were in Hilo, for instance, we met with a woman who her husband had been in and out of prison, and they had both been homeless for a great length of time. even after she got housed, she then reverted back to a houseless state intermittently because her sense of community was extremely strong for people who had, you know, been camping out in the virtually jungle up in Hilo. And the impact of being isolated cannot be understated, and it bleeds right into depression and anxiety, both of which are very, very serious psychological constructs for people of all kinds, but people who are homeless. One of the things that we're working on, and this is not, I wouldn't say controversial, but is a piece of the puzzle, which is to build low-impact communities like what Kahuiki Village is, but even lower impact, which we're using the word Kauhale, which we got from the city. Low impact communities, very low cost, they're not the ultimate solution, of course. They are meant to be permanent supportive housing, dignified housing. But one of the reasons that I'm pushing that so hard and why I want to see one in Nimitz and over in Waimanalo and Waianae, and I think in every region, low impact with social services, with healthcare, is because that sense of connection for individuals who have mental illness and who probably would feel isolated in an apartment, although it is excellent to get someone into permanent stable housing like that, this is a way, and this speaks to the need that we see as healthcare providers on the ground. Some people will do better in that setting as long as it is fully sustainable, as long as it is not some kind of haphazard tossing of services and housing together. It's a really evolving, complex problem, and the isolation is extraordinary for people who first are isolated economically and homeless, and then are isolated psychologically because of their brain.
We have a call. Chris from Oahu has a question that's kind of related to this. Hi, Chris. You're on the line?
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
So I helped build the Holly Maliola Center, our company did, with Connie and Connie crew. And we've been watching it for the last couple of years. We've been back and forth to do some repairs here and there, different stuff. I've noticed, though, that they, and I've talked to some of the guests at the facility, some of them are fine and function well, and they get into their housing that has been provided, and they treat it with some care and a modicum of help. And other people, and it probably tends to be people with either drug or mental issues, really can rip them up and make a mess out of it. And these are units that are built pretty sturdily, but I'm wondering, you know, how do you go about screening people that would go into a community thing like the Navigational Center and not be disruptive and not hurt the very things that people are there to be helped by?
Good question.
And then maybe need to go into more of a more medically trained or medical situation. How do you even do that in this day?
Well, first of all, I would like to really make the distinction between the Hale Maliola Housing Navigation Center and Kahuiki Village. Kahuiki Village is a permanent housing initiative that really gives families an opportunity to access affordable housing after a stint in the shelter. And so it really helps end their homelessness right there. And to the end of, you know, well, how do you know if they're going to be successful or not? Sometimes we don't, but I can tell you that the minimum eligibility is that the people who we accept are people who are working, people who can, by virtue of our assessment of the income, can afford the $725 a month for a single bedroom unit or $900 for a two bedroom unit, and they're clean and sober when they're coming in. Now, whether they relapse, that's another story, you know, and that's where I think our learnings in the first year and a half have been that they really need the support and they really need to be engaged. And so there have been people who have fallen out, but they've fallen out just as they would in any other, apartment building. If you're not paying your rent, then you're going to be asked to leave. And so there have been evictions. This is not a shelter, you know, it's really housing. So I think on that end, we really do our best to give people a chance, but whether people are able to be successful, it depends on their own choices and behaviors.
Okay, we have another question. Michael from Honolulu. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the legal structure. I have also, like another caller, experience working with mentally ill. I've worked with substance abuse and psychotic people in psychiatric setting, as well as in the outpatient setting. And on top of that, I have family experience with it. So my question concerns the historical legacy, and I understand that Hawaii's doing it a little bit different, or quite a bit differently in more recent months, but basically the structure has been for the last 20 or 30 years that it was made much harder for a family member to get their other ill family member committed. And then here's the kicker. Once a mentally ill person, a psychotic person, is committed in the psychiatric institution, they have a right to refuse treatment now. And most people who are psychotic refuse treatment. That's part of the reason they're on the street in the first place, part of the reason they don't seek medical care initially anyway. And so the patient gets their file reviewed after 2 or 3 weeks by the court-appointed officer to do that function. And when the staff hasn't been able to convince them to take the meds, the patient gets sprung. They get released from the hospital.
So what's your question?
I understand that there's some change afoot, but I would like to have that architecture addressed if possible, please.
Sure. The ACT order, assisted community treatment law that passed a few years ago, we've had to amend it a few times, but this past year in the legislature, we think we maybe got it as close as we can get. We reduced the number of criteria from 7 to 4, and it really simply states that the person has to be suffering from a mental illness and has been assessed by, a psychiatrist or an advanced practice nurse, with this prescriptive authority, to indicate that this person would benefit from the treatment. It also describes this inability to take care of themselves, as another criteria, rather than having to be a danger to someone or danger to themselves, to actually have relapsed is another criteria that we could use instead. So it makes it easier for those people who have been treated before to then, get back on treatment and have the court mandate it. So what we've done with the Hawaii State Hospital also is to ask them to make sure that some of these folks who have relapsed before to come out of the hospital with an ACT order, so that the the Attorney General is going to help do that. They've been doing that for a bit now. So we're seeing more of them come out, and we'd really like to see that kind of implemented a whole lot more. So now with the new amendment this last time, when people are coming out of the community hospitals, if a psychiatrist has evaluated them and says that, in fact, they could benefit from, an ACT order, we can start with that, even if that person is released, it's been determined already by someone, and go ahead and file for someone to get court-ordered treatment.
And that will be then, this is Josh, that will be then met with a much more streamlined way to get, in many cases, long-acting medications, which are better than ever now, can last 5 or 6 weeks in the person's system, rather than, of course, trying to take pills every day, which feeds into, the gentleman was very astute, paranoia with psychosis, and that makes it very hard to treat people. There's even medications now that are coming on market that last 3 to 4 months.
That's right.
And so we expect to see a positive revolution in that regard. Also, we have if we can have standing orders for people, because we've seen a lot of the same people over and over again, and the families themselves, our families, my uncle went through this as well, have had to go through this innumerable times, and it's just harder every time. You're exhausted until finally sometimes you just give up and a person becomes homeless and can't get help. So that is the process. So now to revolutionize that system, we need to do a couple things. All the changes that Connie mentioned, we also are working very closely with our public defender's offices and our judges so that they understand, and our ACLU friends, that they understand exactly what we're trying to do, which is decrease suffering and get people the very care that their families want. And believe me, if any one of us around this table was in this desperate need, we would have hoped that we already had done the ACT treatment order so that we wouldn't fall into a 1 year, 5 year, 15 year cycle of being homeless and mentally ill.
We did reach out to the ACLU, and we didn't hear back, but we do hope to have them on the show at some future time.
I think
We'd love to have them at the table.
I think it would be really good because last year, this last legislative session, for the first time, we had a unified agenda, partners in care. We even had the Chamber of Commerce, business community. We had about 100 organizations sign on. And we invited the ACLU, actually, to join our coalition. But they declined because one of our three priorities was around reforming the assisted community treatment law to allow involuntary commitment because of exactly this kind of situation. So we'd love to engage. And we actually reached out to them and said, hey, we want to continue the dialogue because while we come from different perspectives, we all want the same thing. We want to help these people and we want to help their families and the larger community.
And actually, I want to add that assisted community treatment is actually a lesser restrictive intervention than commitment mm-hmm. because it's helping the person stay in the community
yes.
by taking medications. And the as Dr. Green has talked about, you know, it's just a world of difference, the medications that we have to work with. So we just need to use the tools that we have and use them better.
Okay, we have a call coming in from Mountain View. Sharon, what's your question? Hi, Sharon.
Yeah, just had to take it off speaker. Okay, so my first question is I'd like to know how to help out over here in Hilo Side, where to volunteer to advocate for what you guys are talking about, especially like Housing First.
There's a wonderful young doctor that set up her practice there. She trained here at JABSM. I'll remember her name in a moment. Dr. Akiona, and she's doing street medicine, and she has outreach teams going out constantly to connect people into healthcare and housing. She's going to be an asset for you. Of course, the mayor's team is terrific on Big Island. I would call over to Mayor Kim's office and talk to him, his team. Brandy Menino's over there. A lot of them have programs, but they'll know the best ways to volunteer.
Sharon, thank you. Thank you for calling and yes. offering help. We really appreciate that.
May I make a comment?
Yes.
Okay, so I have my master's in social work, but I'm not working right now. I'm thinking of retiring completely. So I work with Child and Family Services in general, and I found that there's something that, you know, there's different gaps in systems that exist right now. There's lots of people who don't want treatment. That's why I think it's great to put in wet houses or Oxford homes or tiny houses where they're accepted exactly as they are, and then basic needs are met, a sense of permanency and permanent housing, and then offering services that use harm reduction.
Thank you. Very good points. We had another call, Marion from Kaneohe, shy caller, but she has a question. She says she has a neighbor who has a self-medicating, homeless, mentally ill son, currently in prison, soon to be released. Who does she contact to send him in the right direction to recovery?
Actually, you could call us at IHS. Actually, if you send an email to info@ihshawaii.org, then you know we might be able to help because we do have outreach workers on the Windward side, and they're trained in mental health as well. And we do have a doctor that goes out periodically if we identify someone that really does need an evaluation.
And we're starting a joint outreach center in Kaneohe.
That's right.
Which
mm-hmm.
is going to be very available. These joint outreach centers, again, provide some health care, a lot of outreach, a lot of housing coordination, a lot of social work. So in each region, as we have those in slightly different hours, we're hoping they'll be more available so a family member can peek in there, talk to us, and take us out to your family member. That kind of hands-on care will ultimately hopefully take care of the despair and the desperation. And then we are opening a 24/7 facility right in Chinatown with the help of everyone. Mayor was great to give us a building. It's a huge appropriation. Councilman Manahan launched the treatment center at the base of it, and it's great service. Yes,
Punavai
Center with Mental Health Kukua. So now we're going to have these other hours of service, so that when people historically said, "Well, maybe I couldn't find a psychologist or treatment or psychiatrist," we'll have it. Maybe they didn't have a normal treatment option without going to the ER and calling the police. Now we'll have it. So I hope people hear hope in our voice. We are treating this as our number one crisis in the state. Notwithstanding some of the recent news, this is what will be with us for a long time coming. And as we see people on the street for more years and more years, they're going to have even greater needs. So we're trying to get on it now.
I think this underscores, you know, why the city has taken such a lead on things like Punavai establishing the Joint Outreach Center down in Chinatown and some of these other interventions, working collaboratively with providers and with the state. You know, we know that even with the public-private partnerships around housing, it's a multi-pronged approach, and it's yielding results. And we just have to keep in this direction.
We've got about another minute left or so. Any final thoughts, Connie?
No, it's just really wonderful to see the synergy that's building in the community and the feedback from the community itself, you know, that people want to help. And that's really awesome.
Okay, we've got those cards.
We have those cards. And I think the main thing is that we work together, we stick with what works, yes, and that we keep our eyes focused on the ball, which is really helping these really vulnerable citizens with community love and evidence-based practices.
And ultimately, housing is healthcare. And by providing housing, we're providing healthcare and decreasing suffering, and that's what all of our goals are about.
Okay. Well, we most definitely had a very interesting conversation this morning. Love the feedback from the community.
Yes,
we would like to thank our guests, Mark Alexander, Executive Director of the Office of Housing, Connie Mitchell, Executive Director of the Institute for Human Services, and Lieutenant Governor Josh Green. And we thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. If your call didn't make it on the air, you can still contact the talkback line. Leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. Send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.